Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Richard Lee.
And me, Claire Armistead.
This week, we speak to two of this year's winners of the Costa Prize for the most enjoyable books of the year. Jonathan Coe, who took the Costa Novel Award, is no stranger to this podcast. We'll be talking to him later about his highly topical novel, Middle England, which begs the question, how on earth do you make Brexit enjoyable? But first, we welcome Sarah Collins, a former barrister, who won the first novel award with a very different sort of tale. The Confessions of Franny Langton is the story of a 19th century trial, where a former slave turned lady's maid is accused of murdering her employers. Claire began by asking Sarah to read from the book as we are introduced to Franny for the first time.
My trial starts the way my life did, a squall of elbows and shoving and spit. From the prisoner's hold, they take me through the gallery, down the stairs, and past the table crawling with barristers and clerks. Around me, a river of faces in flood, their mutters rising, blending with the lawyer's whispers. A noise that hums with all the spite of bees in a bush. Heads turn as I enter, every eye a skewer. I duck my head, peer at my boots, grip my hands to stop their awful trembling. It seems all of London is here, but then murder is the story this city likes best. All of them swollen into the same mood. All of them in a stir about the sensation excited by these most ferocious murders. Those were the words of the Morning Chronicle, itself in the business of harvesting that very sensation like an ink-black crop. I don't make a habit of reading what the broadsheets say about me, for newspapers are like a mirror I saw once in a fair near the Strand that stretched my reflection like a rack, gave me two heads, so I almost didn't know myself. If you've ever had the misfortune to be written about, you know what I mean. But there are turnkeys at Newgate who read them at you for sport. Precious little you can do to get away. When they see I'm not moving, they shove me forward with the flats of their hands and I shiver despite the heat, fumble my way down the steps. Murderer. The word follows me. Murderer. The mulatta murderess.
Thank you very much. Now, hearing you read that passage brought home to me again how incredibly current it seems, even though we're in 1826. I mean, we're talking about the distortion of identity by the media. Hey, what could be more topical in this at the beginning of 2020?
Yes, and alternative facts.
Exactly. Was that what you set out to do?
No, I mean, it's funny. I'm not really sure to what extent you can be setting out to do anything when you're writing a novel, apart from conjuring up a character and trying to get to know them as you develop their predicament. What I really wanted to do was to come up with a page-turning story, and I think the obligation of a novelist to a reader has to prioritize story. That feeling of not being able to sleep until you know how something has turned out, just as simple as that, and also as difficult. But I was writing the story during a very interesting period of time. So I was casting myself back to the early 19th century, but this was during 2015, 2016. So I was also well aware of developments on both sides of the Atlantic. And I was definitely imbued with a mounting sense of anger at how very little progress we had actually made in relation to all of the things I was writing about from an early 19th century perspective. So women's rights and sexuality and even the origins of misguided race science as a justification for even more misguided policies and political initiatives. None of it, although we had been patting ourselves on the back as having emerged into a post-racial society, had actually really moved on that far when you got down to the nitty-gritty of it.
So let's just go back into the story, the plot of the story, which is that, as we've just heard, Franny is in the dock. She's been accused of murder. And the framing is that in order to provide herself with some sort of a defence, she has to provide a story of it for her defence lawyer. And that then takes us back to Jamaica, where she grew up on a plantation.
Yes. One of the things I was very aware of was the need for someone to comment on what Jean Rhys had done. Because, you know, her book was an act of restorative justice. She was trying to reimagine the perspective of the madwoman in the attic. She did a wonderful sort of fleshing out job, if you like, of that. Very few people, I think, have picked up on the fact that it does a disservice to the black female characters. So, you know, the black female characters who come to mind in that book are Amelie, who is the kind of sexual temptress, and I think her name is Christophine, the Obia woman, who sort of pops up every now and again to dispense, you know, a few aphorisms and then disappears. And I've always been left with the sense that there was still something in that balance that could be redressed. And that was looking at those characters, trying to dig beneath those stereotypes. One of the questions I asked myself, which led to my own novel, was, but what if the maid, instead of being the sexual temptress, had been the most intelligent person in the room?
And she's also of mixed heritage, exactly, which is what mulatta means. So yes, in a way, you do dispense of the black, her black carer right at the beginning, don't you? She gets hanged.
Yes.
And this woman who is the sort of child of both cultures is the one who survives.
Yes. And she is torn between those cultures. One of the things that was interesting to me in exploring Franny was the fact that she does have purchase in both cultures, although it's much more difficult for her to identify with the white culture. But what her learning and her education does is give her a strong yearning to identify with one more than the other. And that's a sort of question about this whole wonderful tradition of Western literature, isn't it? Franny being steeped in that, the price she has to pay for it, is this idea that she comes to question her own identity. She has to come to terms with it, which is very difficult to do in early 19th century England, in particular when all of the messages are that the black side of her is less than human.
Yes, and that this brings us on to the sort of proto-eugenics that's going on, which is actually based on a real book that was written.
Yes, I didn't allow myself to speculate very much about all of that because there wouldn't have been any point. First of all, it was more horrific than I could ever have imagined, so there was no need to call on imagination. But also, in order to make the point, I felt it was necessary to be entirely accurate about that so that there couldn't be any argument about it. The thing that surprised me the most was how much material there was about the experimentation, if you could call it that, using the sort of early scientific method which was developing at the time, by some of the leading thinkers of the Enlightenment into this question
of whether whites and blacks were the same,
were the same species. Exactly. And a lot of energy and intellect was devoted to this debate. You know, you had Voltaire flying off to Paris to examine a little albino boy, and Hume writing essays about whether or not black people could rise above the intellect of a parrot. And Jefferson, you know, speculating on the humanity of black people. And of course, it was all tied to the developing reliance on slavery as a source of income and capital. And it was this marvelous example I found of the development of the science being entirely self-serving and therefore entirely mistaken. And then also that question leads to whether or not the development of history as a science was entirely self-serving and entirely mistaken as well.
But also the question about, is science actually another form of fiction?
Yes, yes.
Because if it's misfounded, then it is.
Absolutely. Is everything at the end of the day narrative? And if so, does that mean that all of these narratives which have gone to the development of our sense of ourselves and our world have been manipulated by the people who had the power to control them, namely, you know, the sort of great white men of history?
So against this huge weight of history, you pit the figure of Franny, who is a fantastic character.
Thank you.
I have to say, I'm very delighted, if only by your Costa win, just to see Franny being properly rewarded.
Thank you so much. I mean, yes, it was a tall order pitting Franny against the great weight of history and science. But I think there are ways in which she manages to carve out a triumph for herself in the end.
And she's taught to read for cynical purposes, but she takes to it. But she also uses aphorisms. You allow her to have aphorisms, which you could say are sort of out of what one would expect from her. For example,
yes.
No doubt you think this will be one of those slave histories all sugared over with misery and despair, but who'd want to read one of those?
Yes, and I think that was deliberate. And so far I haven't been accused of anachronism, because I think what is universal about human experience is our response to things. You know, anger doesn't change very much from era to era, nor does love, nor does grief. And so allowing her to kind of manifest the anger that would have been a logical response to what was done to her, I think helps the character to come alive. You know, I remember something Toni Morrison said, that you can't change the future, but you can change the past. And that's the kind of power of historical fiction, that we're constrained to be accurate in relation to events. But there is such fertile ground to explore when it comes to human emotion. And one of the things I think that's been missing is this exploration of female anger and the anger of black women in particular in relation to historical fiction, which obviously Toni Morrison did well. So the kind of the aphoristic expressions that Franny allows herself are kind of geared towards giving some expression to that. You know, she also says a man writes to separate himself from the common history, a woman writes to try to join it. It's the anger of exclusion and the anger of the excluded. Those were the bits that I found probably the most fun to write, actually.
There's an awful lot of reading in the backstory of this, in the background. You have worked as a lawyer for 17 years. You have 5 children.
I know.
How do you manage
How
to do all
I
the
How did I ever
reading?
Do any of this? First of all, they were 17 very miserable years, because the whole time I worked as a lawyer, I knew I wanted nothing more than to write. I had fallen in love with reading very early, and it was a love that never left me. And I'd been part of the conversation as a reader for so long, so filled with admiration for books that had changed my life, that I really did have a very strong urge to, you know, to join the other side of it and to try to write something myself. But then I had to raise 5 children. And so their role in helping me to get published was essentially to start growing up and moving out. By the time my youngest was secondary school age and I had given up work, I finally had enough time on my hands, and I knew if I didn't do it then, you know, I'd sort of hit the big 40 birthday a few years before that. If I didn't do it then, time would probably run out.
So just the last thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is about your imagery, which I was really, really struck. And you know, we talked about Franny's aphorisms, but the sort of your use of words in showing her coming into a literary consciousness, it's not that she wasn't conscious before, is really quite original. For example, when she first sees herself in a mirror and she says, "There I was, stamping towards myself like a wild creature, my own face darting about on the surface like a fish I couldn't catch."
Yes.
Where, I mean, that is a really brilliant piece of evocation.
Oh,
where did
you.
That come from? I mean...
Days and days of hard work. I mean, they were all very hard won these metaphors, because, you know, you want it to come to life on the page, but I think the more lively it is on the page, the more it's probably depleted the author in getting there. It really was a lot of hard work. But what I wanted was, and that's one of the early images of Franny, this sense of a really quick intelligence that was very difficult to pin down, that was wide ranging, and that was fascinating. And that had all the energy of something that was being suppressed, but ultimately couldn't be suppressed. And so I wanted the figurative language of the novel to have the same kind of punch and the same kind of power. But I wish it all came, you know, I've read metaphor is a way of illuminating the truth by putting two, you know, very different things together. And I really do believe in that.
What did it feel like when you heard you'd won the debut novel of the year?
It still hasn't sunk in. I am obviously immensely gratified, but also I'm still walking around in a state of utter disbelief. You know, it's a prize that I have watched as an avid reader for so long. So many of my favorite novelists have been shortlisted and awarded the same prize. That, you know, first of all, to join the tradition of published writers at all was such a huge privilege. But to join it in this fashion is something I don't think I'll ever recover from.
Sarah Collins. The Confessions of Franny Langton is published by Viking Penguin in the UK and Harper in the US. After the break, we'll be speaking to Jonathan Coe and discussing Costa's recipe for an enjoyable read.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. Jonathan Coe burst onto the scene in 1994 with What a Carve-Up, a satirical take on Thatcher's Britain. His sixth novel, The Rotters Club, published in 2001, went back a decade earlier, introducing us to a group of teenage wannabes growing up in the Midlands in the 1970s. The Trotter brothers reappeared, along with some of their friends, in his 2004 sequel, The Closed Circle. Now Coe has taken the Costa Novel Award with Middle England, which brings the Trotters and their gang into the era of Brexit. When he came to the studio, he began by introducing us to the next Trotter generation, Sophie, whose marital problems have a strange symmetry with the paroxysms of Britain's departure from the EU.
A couple might decide to separate for all sorts of reasons: adultery, cruelty, domestic abuse, lack of sex. But a difference of opinion over whether Britain should be a member of the European Union or not seemed absurd. It was absurd. And yet Sophie knew, deep down, that it had not so much been a reason as a tipping point. Ian had reacted, to her mind, so bizarrely to the referendum result, with such gleeful, infantile triumphalism. He kept using the word freedom as if he were the citizen of a tiny African country that had finally won independence from its colonial oppressor. That, for the first time, she genuinely realised that she no longer understood why her husband thought and felt the way that he did. At the same time, she herself had been possessed by the immediate sense that morning that a small but important part of her own identity, her modern, layered, multiple identity, had been taken away from her. During their first session a few weeks later, their relationship counsellor, Lorna, told them that many of the couples she was seeing at the moment had mentioned Brexit as a key factor in their growing estrangement. "I usually start by asking each of you the same question," she said. "Sophie, why are you so angry that Ian voted leave? And Ian, why are you so angry that Sophie voted remain?" Sophie had thought for a long time before answering. "I suppose it's because it made me think that as a person, He's not as open as I thought he was, that his basic model for relationships comes down to antagonism and competition, not cooperation. Lorna had nodded and turned to Ian, who'd answered, "It makes me think that she's very naive, that she lives in a bubble and can't see how other people around her might have a different opinion to hers. And this gives her a certain attitude, an attitude of moral superiority." To which Lorna had said, "What's interesting about both of those answers is that neither of you mentioned politics, as if the referendum wasn't about Europe at all. Maybe something much more fundamental and personal was going on, which is why this might be a difficult problem to resolve." She had suggested a course of 6 sessions, but it turned out that she was being optimistic. In fact, they attended 9 before admitting defeat and calling it a day.
Thank you, Jonathan. That is Sophie and Ian, who Sophie is the niece of Benjamin Trotter, who is a character that we first met back in 2001 in the Rotters Club, who now is a novelist who has just, unlike you, had the mild success of getting a long listing on the Booker for freaky reasons for a novel that no serious publisher wanted to publish. But what you have in Sophie and Ian's relationship is a reflection of the theme of the book, which is Middle England and how we came to be where we are. Why did you decide to go back to this set of characters all this time later?
Well, I had 2 competing ideas for a new book in my mind in early 2016. This would have been, I just published number 11, which was a satirical novel about austerity and about the Cameron government and what their policies had done to the country. And I was thinking about what to write next. I fancied the idea of doing another political state of the nation-ish novel, but I also was beginning to get the sense at that particular moment that the United Kingdom was building up towards a significant moment, some sort of moment of rupture, some sort of moment, some sort of point of no return. I didn't really realise at that point that it was going to be the referendum campaign that marked that, but I felt that things had become socially so strained in the last 5 or 6 years that we were reaching a kind of social breaking point, if you like. So I had a vague idea for a State of the Nation novel, but at the same time, I'd become curious again, to my surprise, about the Rotters Club characters, who were also the Close Circle characters from the first sequel to the book, published in 2004. Normally, when I finish a book and put the final full stop, then the characters leave my imagination completely, and I never even consider going back to them. But because Benjamin was such an autobiographical character, and the Rotters Club was such an autobiographical book, he and his friends and his family had never quite gone away in that same way, and I was starting to feel, as I entered my late 50s, a curiosity about how they were coping with that particular age as well. You know, it suddenly became clear to me that these 2 ideas needn't be in competition, that in fact the State of the Nation book that I wanted to write could also be Rotters Club Volume 3.
So just to recap a little bit on the situation, the central characters met up at King William's School, which is a fictionalisation of a school you went to, grammar school you went to in Birmingham, which is in the middle of England, hence the title Middle England in a way, although we don't usually use Middle England to mean Birmingham, do we?
No, I've been publicising the book abroad a lot recently, and they're very exercised by this phrase, Middle England, and the translation difficulties it's created. And I do have to explain that it's not, although the book is geographically set in the heart of England, a lot of it, that's not really what Middle England means. And Middle England is really an attitude and a political philosophy. Middle England is like the Shire in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, there's quite a lot of riffing on Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, well, you know, Tolkien to me is a great novelist of the Midlands. That's I love the Lord of the Rings on many different levels, but that's the one I love it on the most. I think that to me, Frodo and Sam are two kind of provincial Birmingham boys who get called away to do great deeds in the wider world, and then come back to the Midlands kind of older and wiser and stronger as a result.
Oh, a bit like you.
Well, in some ways, yeah.
I mean that's interesting that you're so influenced by The Lord of the Rings, because this is you are not a fantasy writer. Your writing is sort of social comedy or bordering on satire. Now, I know What a Carve-Up was described as satire. I would say this is more social comedy.
Yes,
than,
definitely more social
satire.
Comedy. Apart from the set piece dialogues between the political journalist and David Cameron's spin doctor, of which there are five, and which are straight out of Yes Minister or The Thick of It or Veep or something.
But knockabout with involving two clowns.
Yes. Yeah, that's the only kind of surreal touch in the book, but that's completely taken from life. I mean, a few years ago I met up again with my first school friend from primary school, who I knew when I was 5 years old, who is now a children's entertainer in the Midlands, and has this kind of, for a while, had this strange feud going on with another children's entertainer. And it wasn't as if they were, one was for Brexit and one was for Remain. But that's the only little gloss of unreality I put onto it. The rest of it is all pretty much real.
The point about that knockabout between the two clowns, in a way, is about uncontained anger, isn't it? Mm. Anger that blows up over something that is trivial and then gets completely out of control.
Yeah, well, another key passage in the book, I think, is the passage where Nahid, the woman who takes speed awareness courses for miscreant drivers, is talking to Sophie after they've had their training session, and Sophie has remarked on how angry everybody in the class seemed to be, and he says, yes, everybody is getting angry these days, and she feels it's because it's one of the most readily accessible emotions, you know, and we're all going around in a state of slight emotional deadness and anomie, and we're desperate to feel something, and feeling angry, you know, even if it's just a momentary kick of anger at a fellow driver when you're stuck in a traffic jam or something, it brings your emotions to life, and that's something these days. That's something we need. One of the things that surprised me when I went back to look at The Rotters Club and The Closed Circle, because I had to skim read those books again to make sure that I knew, you know, how to continue the story, is that there's a big riff on this at the beginning of The Closed Circle, which I would have written in 2004, so 15 years ago, where Claire comes back from living in Italy, and the first thing that strikes her about being back in London and being back in England is how angry everybody sees, and there's this kind of constant low-level irritation. And I think that has, you know, built and built and erupted into something quite significant since 2016.
So the book is called Middle England. It divides into three sections, and the three sections are Merry England, Deep England, and then finally Old England. What is the significance particularly of Deep England? That's not a term I'm particularly familiar with.
It's a term you find being used by psychogeographers sometimes, film commentators sometimes. It is meant, I think, to describe and evoke those rural or village pockets of England which still exist, which are remote, more than usually cut off from the metropolis and the life of the capital, and where, you know, folklore is still important, a strong sense of English traditions going back, almost having a kind of slightly Wicker Man-ish kind of feel.
You don't have a lot of characters living in, who are disaffected because of living in poverty, because of having suffered the effects of austerity. Mm. You have a rather likeable Asian woman and her daughter who have suffered extreme poverty. Most of these people are cross because they feel that the status quo is being threatened.
Yeah, I mean, I'm middle class myself, and I write best about the middle classes, I think. And it's true that many of the characters in the book are actually quite well off, but it doesn't seem to make them any more content with their lot. And curious feature of what I've heard Leave voters say over the last 3 years to me is that when you try to argue with them and say, you know, that we're going to be worse off if we leave the European Union and the economy is going to suffer and this kind of thing, then a lot of the time they will say, well, it's not about money as far as I'm concerned. At which point, you know, you have to ask, in that case, what is it about? You know, I think for a lot of the characters in my book, a lot of the Leave voters in my book, they're motivated by resentment and a sense of injustice. And as the epigraph to the Deep England section says, a sense of loss of privilege, really. That as social attitudes have changed over the last few decades, they've been asked to step aside and make way for, you know, other people, other voices.
The timescale is April 2010 to September 2018, which means that you miss out on what happened in 2019. Would it have changed had you been writing it over a slightly later timescale, do you think?
I made the book not just as up-to-date as I could, but more up-to-date than I could, really, because I finished writing it in April 2018, and the final chapter is set in September 2018. So I was looking forward tentatively into the future there as far as I could. But I couldn't... You know, the referendum result, to me, as well as marking the beginning of something, also marked the end of something. And this is really a book about some of the roots of the Brexit movement and how they led up to June 2016. What's come since then is for another book, I think, and it will take quite a few years before I or any other writer, I think, has enough perspective on it to be able to write about what's happening now, because we're entering into a totally new chapter. And that chapter really started on Friday, 13th of December last year, I think, with Johnson getting his majority. I think that has been the decisive thing.
Very finally, when I was thinking about what the takeout of it was, I thought it occurred to me that actually what it's about is fraternity. And you have fraternity literally in that it's about brothers and sisters,
yes,
and family relationships that are not marital necessarily.
Yeah.
But it's also about couples who've been a long time together, who perhaps not perfectly matched, finding a way of continuing to be together.
Yeah, well, that was sort of the best metaphor I could find for what the country now has to do, I think. You know, there's a lot of talk about healing and bringing the country together and so on, and it's not obvious to me how that is really going to happen if we press ahead with an ultra-hard Brexit in defiance of the wishes of 48% of the electorate. But if the United Kingdom or even England is going to survive as an entity, then we're going to have to find a way of burying our differences again and getting on with it. And a couple in their 50s who kind of decide, okay, so we're not perfect for each other, but we've got this far and we've been through this much. We might as well battle it out. Is as good a point of comparison as any, I think.
So, you know, quite downbeat in a way, downbeat in subject matter. It doesn't aspire to joy, but it's just won a prize which is specifically for the most enjoyable novel of the year. That's a real feat to pull off.
I hope it's enjoyable. As you say, there's a lot of comedy in the book, and a lot of kind of kindness and gentleness in the book, I think, between the different characters. That was one of the things I wanted to try and capture from the texture of daily life still, because I think that, you know, it's easy to forget that all that is going on while we're kind of slagging each other off on Twitter. And it does end on a note of kind of fragile optimism.
Based in mainland Europe.
with a kind of multi-international list of dinner guests gathered around a table in the south of France. And that final chapter is not as realistic as the other chapters. To me, it has a kind of fantasy element to it. It's like a retreat into the magic forest where things can be worked out in non-political ways. But for me, in the short term at the moment, as I said, particularly with the election result of last month, it's a bit hard to see how this is going to play out in a good way over the next few years.
Jonathan Coe. Middle England is published by Penguin.
The Booker Prize rewards the finest in fiction. The Nobel tries to find the most outstanding work in an ideal direction, while the Pulitzers are looking for distinguished fiction by an American author, preferably dealing with American life. But ever since they were founded in 1971, the Costa Book Awards, formerly the Whitbreads, have been celebrating the most enjoyable books of the year. So, Claire, what exactly is an enjoyable book?
Ah, oh, yes. Well, this is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Well, the question that publishers hope will and booksellers hope will amount to $1 million. Franny Langton's obviously pretty harrowing in its subject matter.
Yes.
But it is what you might call in old book speak a rollicking read.
A page-turner.
A page-turner. So what enjoyable, I think, means really is appealing to a wide and hopefully an extra-literary readership, so i.e. people who don't read books all the time.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for us to imagine sometimes that there are people who don't read books, but they do exist.
They do, and sort of people who, you know, who might buy a book for their mum or choose it for their book group. So it's all about books that will sell, and it's in deliberate contradistinction to the Booker's finest in fiction. Mm. So because every prize needs to have a bit of a personality of its own.
Though the Booker was always supposed to be a way of selling more books, but I guess it was always an appeal to the kind of your finer instincts, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously a great novel will sell a lot of books, depending, you know, regardless of whether it's higher or lower. But that isn't always the case.
Yeah, a bit of brand, isn't it?
But I actually think that this Costa, although it you know, you can sneer at it, it's actually produced some very good winners. So of the Book of the Year, which is the next stage that Jonathan and Sarah will go to, the winners, past winners, have included Kate Atkinson's Behind the Scenes at the Museum, Andrea Levy's Small Island, Mark Haddon's Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
Mm. All great books, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not all about fiction, is it? These two novels are up against Jasbinder Bilan's novel for children, Asher and the Spirit Bird, Mary Jean Chan's collection of poetry, Flesh, and Jack Fairweather's biography of Witold Pilecki, The Volunteer. So what have judges enjoyed in terms of genre throughout the years?
Well, if we're laughing at the term enjoyable, the Witold Pilecki's Volunteer...
Laughing in a fond way.
This is Witold Pilecki is about a man who infiltrated himself into Auschwitz in order to report on what was going on the inside and then was executed. So, I mean, it's not obviously enjoyable, but you know, it's a well-told story of it, and it's also an important story. If you're looking at how it's shaken down over the years, the novels of the year usually win the Book of the Year, but there's actually more poetry than you'd expect. I did a rough count, and it seems to be 13 novels, 5 first novels, 8 poetry collections, and 7 biographies. But the 8 poetry collections, 4 of those 8 poetry collections were by famous Seamus and Ted Hughes, even more famous Ted Hughes.
So yes, indeed. So there's certainly a certain amount of kind of brand quality there, isn't there? I mean, I suppose there's always been some sort of tension between the idea of something enjoyable and something that's really good.
Yeah, here's a bit of gossip that hasn't been heard in public before. When I judged the Costa Biography Prize in 2004, and it also handily involves Jonathan Coe, who was up for it with his biography of the avant-garde novelist B.S. Johnson. His biography was called Like a Fiery Elephant, and it was written in a sort of B.S. Johnson experimental style. And one of my fellow judges, who shall remain nameless,
<Go on>.
flounced into the room and said, "If you're going to argue for the Coe, I'm walking out."
Oh, blimey.
So actually, there was no argument against that. I sort of docilely submitted. And he did go on to win the Samuel Johnson Prize, which is for non-fiction, and actually was probably a better prize for that book. Although it was greatly to be admired. I thought it was a great biography. Like all gossip, I think this anecdote is quite telling in that Coe is actually a writer's writer. He's a real stylist and book nerd, as he confessed himself just then, who happens to have chosen social comedy as the vehicle for his fiction. And comedy, as we know, rarely wins the Booker Prize. It rarely wins serious literary prizes.
Yeah, much, much underrated, isn't it? But do you think he's in with a shout at the Costas?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so topical. And I think that sense of something that everybody is thinking about, i.e. it's a subject that resonates, is a very important part of an enjoyable book.
A subject, in his case, we can't hardly avoid.
Yeah, although I have to say, I was talking to someone the other day who thought it might be more enjoyable for for foreign readers who hadn't actually had to live through all the events he's describing, and to have them repeated in such sort of grim detail can be quite dispiriting and unenjoyable.
But he's already very big on the continent, isn't he?
Yeah, he's massively popular in Belgium and France and I think Germany. Mm. And that's interesting as well, because I think I've said this formally I don't think he's had the recognition he deserves here. And I think that is partly to do with his choice of comedy. But also he has a sort of certain sort of deadpan style, which.
Too sophisticated for us Brits.
Yeah, let's put it like that and get everybody's backs up. Anyway, and Franny Langton is topical in a very different way, in that it's a revisionist look at Britain's slaving history and the hypocrisies around race, which resonate very strongly in this era of you know, the Windrush scandal, which is all about our mistreatment of people who come from precisely the former colonies that Sarah Collins is writing about.
I guess also a very interesting novel in the age of Me Too as well. We'll find out who'll be crowned the winner of the Costa Book of the Year later this evening, but that's all for this week. Next week we talk to Adam Rutherford, who's examining why racists have a problem with science. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, get in touch on Twitter @GuardianBooks or on the podcast page. And remember, you can always subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, from me, Richard Lee.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.